Good evening. So I thought that, so today, because I seem to keep going, you know, I always say, okay, I try this a lot, about 20 minutes at the end of the session to do a, introduce you to a meditation to develop compassion, to develop you know, the mind of how to use our adversity maybe to, you know, for benefiting others, and especially at times when we do face adversity. So, but I never seem to be able to do it because I always run over, right? So this time I thought I'd start it with it, right? And that way, you know, I think it won't matter if I, you know, run over. So it's called, there's two, if you read the Lam Rim text, they talk about there's two ways of developing the mind of compassion, right? So one is, you know, they call it the 7-point cause and effect, where you think about your, you develop equanimity, you think about your, your mother and how much how much she meant to you and how much she cared for you and so forth and so on. You try to kind of see how other beings are like her and, you know, try to extend that feeling of love and compassion, for your mother to other beings, right? So that's one way to generate this, compassion. The other one is called, you know, taking and giving. Which is, you know, another, you know, I think Geshe-la has talked about it as Tonglen practice, right? So I thought that, you know, we can do the Tonglen practice to kind of, you know, get a feeling of how to generate it. And it would be wonderful. And I'll introduce you to it. And it's, I'm not going to do the meditation, but I found a meditation by Rinpoche, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. So I thought that would be of much more benefit to you than me just trying to make up something. So I'm going to do that, but the reason I'm kind of introducing you to it now is because it would be wonderful if during the next 3 or 4 sessions that we have during the week, if you can do something like that on a relatively regular basis, right? Because that's how we generate, that's how we can build up our mind of compassion, right? It's like going to the gym, right? I mean, if you go one evening on a Monday every week, then, you know, you probably won't get much benefit, right? You might actually hurt yourself, but, you know, that's another story. But if you do, you know, do it regularly during the week, then, you know, you'll actually gain benefit, right? So hopefully, you know, so I'm going to introduce you to it, and hopefully you'll do it during the week. And maybe next time, Joanna, I might just, you know, just send you the practice, you know, that Rinpoche has, and maybe we can just have some handouts to give people, and that way they actually have something, you know. I didn't have it in time for this class. Okay, so let's just get started then. So we'll start with a short breathing meditation like we normally do, and then I'll just go straight into the Tonglen practice. So if you remember, the most important thing is to have a relatively comfortable but straight back with a natural curve, and to place our mind on the breath. Those of you who came to this weekend's calm abiding sessions with Geshe-la, you can use some of the lessons that he gave. Instructions that he gave for placing our mind on the breath.
Remember the purpose of taking and giving meditation. By generating great compassion, we take suffering and the causes of suffering of numberless sentient beings within ourselves and use them to destroy our self-cherishing thought, the source of all our problems. By generating great loving kindness, we give other living beings everything that we have, our body, our relatives and friends and our possessions, our merit and our happiness. So check your posture. Make sure your spine is straight, shoulders are back and relaxed, mouth and jaw relaxed. Feel the weight of your body on the cushion. Set the motivation thinking that at this very moment, all our kind mother sentient beings are experiencing great suffering. But they're also running constantly to create the cause for more. There's not even a second in which they can experience a moment's happiness. If a mother's suffering is not alleviated by her own child, then who else will do it? At the moment, I'm incapable of relieving the suffering of even one sentient being. Yet, if I receive the enlightened holy body, just one ray of its light could ripen on the minds of countless sentient beings, leading them to the state of greatest peace. Therefore, to release all mother sentient beings from suffering and lead them to the sublime happiness of enlightenment, I must attain the exalted state of a Buddha. The attainment of Buddhahood is not without causes and conditions. Its principal cause is the two bodhicittas. Therefore, I'm going to practice the profound method of taking and giving meditation. First, generate compassion by thinking how living beings constantly experience suffering, even though they have no wish to do so, because they are ignorant of its causes. Or because they know the cause of suffering, they are too lazy to abandon them. Think how wonderful it would be if all living beings could be free from all suffering and the cause of suffering, karma and delusion. I myself will free them from all their suffering and its causes. So that's the Bodhisattva intention. As you breathe in, imagine you take all the suffering and the cause of suffering of other living beings through your nostrils in the form of black smoke. If you have an illness of some other illness or some other problem, focus first on all the numberless other beings with that same problem. So if we're going through some kind of adversity now, we can think of other beings most likely are going through the same adversity. Many other beings most likely. So we can think of their suffering just like ours. Then think of all the other problems experienced by living beings as well as their causes. So we know our friends, our families, you know, the sufferings they go through. We see suffering on the news, all the refugees and so as you breathe in, so as you slowly breathe in the black smoke, take in all the suffering and its causes. like plucking a thorn out of their flesh, you immediately free all numberless beings from all their suffering. So we can think like that, that we take in their suffering like black smoke, and it frees them. And you can try to visualize it as best as you can. I mean, make it as vivid as you can. Next, take all the subtle obscurations from the arhats and the higher bodhisattvas. Arhats are beings who have attained realization of emptiness. Arhats and higher bodhisattvas. There is nothing to take from the gurus and buddhas. All you can do is make offerings to them. So black smoke comes in through your nostrils and absorbs into the self-cherishing thought in your heart, completely destroying it. So you can imagine the black smoke coming from all the ordinary beings and also from the arhats and bodhisattvas, and absorbs into our self-cherishing thought in our heart, completely destroying it. Your self-cherishing, the creator of all your problems, becomes non-existent. Like aiming a missile right on the target. Aim right at the self-cherishing thought, the target in this meditation. So let's do that for a bit. Take from others all the undesirable environments that they experience. Breathe in through your nostrils in the form of black smoke all the undesirable places the sentient beings experience. Like the inhospitable environments, the hungry ghosts and the animals and hell realms, on the dirty places that human beings live in today. The black smoke comes in through your nostrils and down into your heart, where it absorbs into your self-cherishing thought and completely destroys it. The self-cherishing thought becomes non-existent. It's important, the reason I said to make it as vivid as possible is instructions say that it's important to really try to make it real as much as possible. Because that's when it works the best. At the same time as your self-cherishing becomes completely non-existent, the false I that ignorance holds to be truly existent also becomes completely empty, as it is empty in reality. Meditate for as long as possible on this emptiness, the ultimate nature of the I. So whatever understanding you have of how the self doesn't exist the way it seems, the inherent way it seems, so you can kind of meditate on that. If not, if you have an understanding of the space-like nature of mind, you can meditate on that. Or just meditate on the how the self just doesn't exist the way we think, that's how solid it appears to us. Because we have a clear understanding of what the self is. But it changes from day to day. We're not the same self that we were a year ago, for example. Or if you try to find the self, you can't actually find it. Yet we are so attached to it and we will do anything for it. So just like that, that self-cherishing brings us so much problems. All these countless beings, they have the same cherishing of the self. And how many problems it brings them, maybe even worse problems than what we're facing today. So next, generate loving kindness by thinking that even though living beings want to be happy, they lack happiness because they're ignorant of its causes or lazy in generating them. And even if they achieve some temporary happiness, they still lack the ultimate happiness of full enlightenment. Think how wonderful it would be if all living beings had happiness and the cause of happiness. I myself would bring them happiness and its causes. Visualize your body as a wish-granting jewel which can grant all the wishes of living beings. Then give everything you have to every human being. Give all your good karma of the three times and all the happiness that results from it up to enlightenment. Your possessions, your family and friends, your body visualized as a wish-granting jewel. Human beings receive everything that they want, including all the realizations of the past enlightenment. Those who want a friend find a friend. Those who want a guru find a perfect guru. Those who want a job find a job. Those who want a doctor find a qualified doctor. Those who want medicine find medicine. For those with incurable diseases, you become the medicine that cures them. So we are the instrument of all the happiness of all these beings. Since the main human problem is difficulty in finding the means of living image that each human being is you can also think that the environment becomes a pure land. The pure land of Amitabha, or the Buddha of compassion, for example. You grant all human beings everything they want, including a pure land with perfect enjoyments. All these enjoyments cause them only to generate the path to enlightenment within their mind, and they all become enlightened. In a similar way, give to the worldly gods everything they need, such as protective armor. They also become enlightened. Then give to all the hell beings and completely transform their environments into blissful, pure land with perfect enjoyments and no suffering at all. Visualize the hells as pure realms, as beautiful as possible. All the iron houses of hell beings which are one with fire become jewel palaces and mandalas. All the hell beings receive everything they want and then become enlightened. Then for the hungry ghost, transform the environment into a pure realm and give them thousands of different foods that all taste like nectar, to have perfect enjoyments and no suffering at all. Their environment is pure and beautiful. The hungry ghosts receive everything they need, but the ultimate point is that they all become enlightened. Since animals mainly need protection, manifest as Vajrapani, the Buddha of skillful means, or another wrathful deity to protect them from being attacked by other animals. They receive everything they want, and everything they receive becomes a cause for them to actualize the path and become enlightened. Give also to the arhats and the bodhisattvas. Give them whatever realizations they need to complete the path to enlightenment. So in this way, we become like the wish-granting jewel that we talked about in the first class. All beings reach their ultimate happiness through us. After everyone has become enlightened in this way, rejoice by thinking how wonderful it is that I have enlightened every single living being. I dedicate any merits that have thus created to the swift enlightenment of all sentient beings. May I become enlightened to benefit all. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more.
So Rinpoche here, you know, there's another way sometimes that in the text you can do, oh, thank you, thing that you can, that's fine. Rinpoche didn't explicitly do the, you know, we did the taking, you know, with, as black smoke, the suffering of all beings, right? And it destroys the self-cherishing thought in our heart, right? And so he did the, you know, like, imagine that everyone becomes enlightened, right? All the beings in the different realms. Another way that some, you know, that the texts talk about is, you can also imagine, like, after the the self-searching thought in your heart gets destroyed. It transforms the black smoke into white light, and you can imagine giving it to all the beings. Right? So that's a kind of an extra visualization. You know, you can do Rinpoche's meditation, but you can add the visualization as well, you know, as they're becoming light and the white light goes to them. And so this technique actually is very powerful. You know, even though you may think, at least when I started doing it, I thought, oh, this must kind of sound like a little hokey. You know, how am I going to enlighten all these beings, right? But the interesting thing is that it's not the, whether or not they become enlightened is not the real thing here, right? The point is that it changes our heart, right? I mean, that's this effect. With giving the enlightenment to all beings, we set up the aspiration like we talked about, right? It creates the aspiration, creates the causes for us to become that wish-granting jewel at some point, right? When we become enlightened, we will become that wish-granting jewel. But in the meantime, this fake it till you make it approach changes the way we think or changes the way we act. Right? And that's why this technique works. So that's why it's not hokey, even though it appears hokey, it's not hokey, right? And that's how the, you know, that's why they talk about this technique as, so there's, as I said, there are two techniques, right? They talk about Lam Rim, one is a 7-point cause and effect, and the other one is taking and giving. And it talks about the taking and giving as a little is for, it says, more advanced practitioners. Because it's not as clear, you know, it's not as, the other one, the 7-point cause and effect, you can see the direct, how it kind of affects change in your heart, right? This one works differently, but it works just the same, right? So the 7-point cause and effect is also there in the Lam Rim. Right? You can try both of them if you wish and see what works for you. Right? I did both of them and this one works for me. Right? So that's how I kind of stuck with this one. That doesn't mean I'm an advanced practitioner, believe me. It just means that it just happens to work better for me than others. Right? So it's like that. So you can try the 7-point cause and effect. If I find a good 7-point cause and effect meditation, then I'll do it. But we'll see. This is called the taking and giving. It's the Tonglen practice. The other thing, by the way, about this practice is sometimes people get kind of a little worried that, oh my God, I'm taking in the suffering of all these beings. You know, I can barely handle my own suffering. Well, I don't want to take on somebody else's suffering, right? So, again, if you remember the karma teachings, right? You can't, their karma cannot affect you. Right, because karma only is, you know, my karma manifests itself in results only in me, right? Only in my mind stream, only in my lifetime or next life, whatever, right? And so it is with yours, right? But Joanna's karma, even though I may take her suffering, does not ripen on me, right? So you don't have to worry about it. But again, the taking on the suffering is about destroying the delusions that we have, right? The self-cherishing thought. That's what it's about. So that's one thing that people always kind of ask about. One time I was at a teaching once and he said that, you know, as I said, you know, all the teachers always say to make it as vivid as possible, right? To make it as real as possible, right? To get past, you know, it's real when as the black smoke enters your heart and you take on the suffering, you kind of get this feeling of being a little scared, you know, like it almost appears real, which I had never heard anybody say that, but actually, kind of worked, you know. So you can try that too, you know. And you can, and the Lamrim text, of course, has, you know, and there are many, you can go on to many other meditations by Rinpoche or Lama Yeshe. If you go to Lama Yeshe, you know, those of you, I don't know if you know or not, there's a great website called Lama Yeshe, LamaYeshe.org or com, I can't remember. I think it's org.org. In any case, it has archived, you know, 40 years of teachings by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Lama Yeshe, His Holiness Dalai Lama, various other teachers in this tradition, right? It has, you know, text, it has teachings, it has audio, sometimes even some video, if it's a recent teaching, things like that, right? So, and you can just do a search, you know, tongue, you know, taking and giving, and it'll come up, pop up with all the different, you know, so you can see what other teachers had to say, right? So you can kind of use that to enrich your practice, right? Because you kind of get stale, so you kind of go and read some what somebody else said, and kind of gives you new ideas and makes it more fun in a way, you know. So lamayashi.org, and I'm thinking what else. But in any case, so if you can, this doesn't have to take a long time, right? I mean, you know, I was reading this whole thing, and it takes a long time because I'm kind of reading and pausing after every sentence and so forth and so on, right? But you can easily, if you, you know, set aside 5 minutes, 7 minutes in the morning, right? That's all it really needs to take, right? To kind of just have a regular practice where, you know, I mean, it's 5 minutes really well spent. If it actually destroys your self-cherishing thought, you know, you can't spend a better 5 minutes, right? That's number one. And I guess if it doesn't work for you, then it's only 5 minutes. That's another way to look at it, right? So you know, and you can imagine, you know, you can just imagine the various beings, you know, and their sufferings. You can, you know, you, whatever problems you're going through at this very moment, you can imagine all the other people who must be having those same problems, right? With their, you know, if you have problems with your relationships with your family or at work or physical illnesses, you know, mental health problems, you know, all kinds of things, right? We're not, there's no problem that we're facing that where I'm the only one who's facing it. I'm pretty darn sure that's the case. So, if somebody else is facing it, then you can imagine what their pain and suffering must be. So you can use that as a way of generating compassion. It gets us, as we talk, it gets us out of ourselves, right? I mean, that's the whole thing about problems, right? We tend to kind of wallow in it. You know, it kind of gets us depressed, kind of gets us down and all these things, right? But if we kind of broaden our horizon, you know, expand it, and think about others who are facing the same problem and how much pain and suffering they must go through, right? Then it's not, we cherish ourselves a little less, you know, and it alleviates our depression, being down, you know. And you'll find that to be the case if you actually really make an effort. You'll see. Actually, this reminds me of, I tell the story I think some of you may have heard this already, but I have a friend of mine, you know, in the spiritual brother, if you will, and so he had been, you know, we discussed stuff like this, and so he was, you know, he's been doing, you know, the compassion practice for some years, and he was going through. You know, he would have this incredible pain in his stomach, right? He would wake up in the middle of the night and would have such intense pain that, you know, he would almost, you know, want to throw up, you know? And it was just, yeah, I mean, it was really, you know, he really didn't know what to do. Anyway, doctors couldn't figure it out. They thought it might be gallstone, blah, blah, blah. They never knew. In any case, so one time he was had this pain at night, And he went and he just kind of, I guess he needed to pee. And so he went to the bathroom and he sat on the toilet. And it was so the pain was so searing that he thought he was actually going to die. You know, he didn't really think that he really was going to live. But at that very moment, he thought, oh, I wonder what Rinpoche would do, right? What is his instruction, right? And he thought, oh, there's that compassion thing, right? So he started thinking about, like, the pain and about how other beings who must be in pain like him at that very moment, right? So he thought that, okay, at least if I'm going to die, I'm going to have a positive mind when I die, right? So he started doing that, right? So he started doing this taking and giving, the black smoke, white smoke business, right? And so the good news is he lived because he told me the story. But you already know the ending. But what happened was actually he was doing this practice and he fainted. I mean, the pain, you know, because of the pain, you know, so he fell on the ground. He had a, you know, concussion, blah, blah, blah. But at least it wasn't death, right? But he said that, you know, later when he was telling me, he said that, you know, the pain became a little bearable, right? That was the interesting thing. When he was doing this practice, even though he was in the same pain that he was before he started, right? It became bearable, right? So he wasn't thinking so much of, oh my God, what am I going to do? Blah, 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 right? His mind was in a different place, right? So that's kind of like why it works, right? That's kind of how it works, if you will, right? I'm just kind of giving you an example, like, so you can have a feeling of how it can develop, right? And there are many other stories like this. You know, if you read Rinpoche, you know, one of the, there's a book out called Dear Lama Zopa, I think it's called. Dear Lama Zopa, where I'm already spending so much time. Well, anyway, it's okay. It's a good cause. It's called Dear Lama Zopa, and it's basically letters that his students have written, right? So, you know, those of us as students, I mean, when we face problems that we can't seem to figure out what to do, we write him a letter, right? Or email nowadays, whatever. And he responds, right? He reads all the emails and letters, and he responds, right? So it's a collection of the letters that people have written and his responses, right? And it's very interesting. If you read it, like people who are dying of cancer, write in, you know, what should I do, right? And so he gives them this practice. He said, do this day and night, right? And it definitely changes them, right? Because I know some of them. And in others, I know of them. I don't know them personally, but I know of them. You know, there's a couple of actually stories of this in the books. I mean, where, you know, basically it was whatever you call it, end stage cancer, you know, the terminal, you know, terminals, whatever stage, you know, there was nothing they can do. I mean, even, you know, the radiology, right? It wasn't going to be of any help, et cetera, right? But this person, these few people, you know, they started doing this practice and somehow over a few number of months, their cancer subsided, right? They had a full recovery and nobody knew how. Now, you know, I don't know if there's a direct causal relationship here, but I tend to think so, you know? So who knows how it works, right? But it does work. So if you can spend the 5 minutes and do this on a regular basis, not just while we're doing this class, but hopefully afterward as well, right? It can be of great benefit, you know, next time we face adversity, or even while we're facing adversity while we're taking this class. I'm sure that all of us in some form or fashion is facing some adversity right at this very moment, right? I am. I'm sure you are, right? So, anyway, anybody have any questions about this practice or what to do or what not to do? No?
Comment.
Sure. Wait, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
People on the ether are listening.
Okay. I just searched that taking and giving Zopa Rinpoche and found it. So it was on Kadampa's site.
Oh, well, yeah. There we go.
So.
Oh, it's on Kadampa's?
Yeah. You can't get to it through the site itself, but I found
should
it
do a search?
Google. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. There we go. I know that one last time I was doing this class, I think I might have put it up on the way. So it might be the same one. I don't know. Yeah. Okay.
I was reading the thought transformation, and it talked about it. I thought it was fairly interesting. It talked about how we say we're going to take on the suffering of all others, and how we're surprised when we start to suffer. And I suddenly had this panicky feeling of, okay, so obviously that self-preservation kicks in, and how do you let go of that panic feeling? I don't, if that's...
So when do you have this, I'm sorry, I didn't quite...
Well, I was reading the thought transformation, and it talked about, you know, bodhicitta and bodhisattva and taking on the suffering of others. And when you take on the suffering of others, you know, why are people so surprised when suffering occurs? And that's the idea of it. And if that's the idea of it, of course my self-preservation kicks in.
Oh, I see. So the taking on the suffering of others won't cause suffering. That's not, so their suffering isn't going to cause suffering for you. However, what it does say is, as we are changing our minds, you know, we are purifying our karma, right? I mean, as this practice, along with other practices, you know, like this, right? They purify existing negative karma that we've created in the past, right? And so when that happens, some of that karma, our own karma, can ripen, but in lesser form. Okay, so in other words, what they say is a lot of times, when you are doing these practices and also doing other things, the Lam Rim and so forth and so on, right? It can actually bring on more suffering, which is not, it says, don't be surprised, right? And the reason, and they say that be happy because you know, that's when you know it's working, right? Mm-hmm. And how does it manifest? So basically what Rinpoche says is, let's say that you have created the karma in the past of killing, right? If you've killed somebody or an animal, whatever it is, right? Which, as you know, creates the karma of being killed, right? Or at least, of course, not being killed, at least being born in a very terrible place and all that stuff. You know, you can read the karma chapter. So if you do these practices and if it purifies that karma of killing, then it might manifest itself as a karma of, as it manifests itself as, like, an illness, like this, my friend who had this terrible pain and almost thought he was going to die, so forth and so on, right? So it manifests itself as a less severe form. The results are less severe than otherwise would be, right? So that's what Rinpoche says, I mean, and that's what other teachers say as well, and that's what the texts say, right? So in that way, it can bring on suffering in the short term. But suffering, their suffering isn't going to come up on you. Right? So if somebody else, you know, has created the karma of killing and you're taking on their suffering, that karma of killing is not going to manifest on you. Right? So in that way, so then if self-preservation still kicks in, right? Or I guess a self-cherishing thought. I don't know.
Self-cherishing is such an innate part of who we are. And trying to separate it is darn near impossible.
Well, you know, sometimes what I've found works when that self-cherishing thought arises, because a lot of times when that arises, if we haven't studied the path at all, we just kind of go willy-nilly follow the self-cherishing thought wherever it goes, right? If we have studied the path some, then we have some understanding of the self-cherishing thought and we say, oh, there it is, right there, right? And then we try to like negate it, mm-hmm. right? Which makes it worse because we're resisting it, right? you know, when we are much more realized, that will work. But at this ordinary, with the ordinary mind that we have, it won't work, right? It's just, because it's, as you said, it's innate. It's just, it's very, very powerful, right? So resisting it is not going to work at this point. So what I found worked is that you just kind of just let it be. You just kind of sit there and you're like, oh, there it is, my old friend, right? Like that. You know, it's kind of like, look at it as a friend, right? You know, it's been with us, with me forever, you know, for countless lives, countless, you know, lives. And it will be with me again, continue to with me for a long time, right? So, you know, you might as well enjoy the ride in a way, right? But in the meantime, we kind of make little progress, right? We don't have to like tie ourselves in knots and just trying to like stop it right here, right now, just go cold turkey, because it's not going to happen, right? But we can kind of just let it be, just let it observe it, just sit there. We don't have to let it, you know, as I said, if we've studied the Dharma some, we know not to let it govern our actions necessarily. If we have that presence of mind, if we have built up that through these practices, through compassion, through emptiness, through all these different things that we study, right? If we're able to use that to not have the self-cherishing thought, you know, govern our actions, then we can just, you know, just let it just be there, right? It's not going to harm anything. It's not going to go away, as I said, anytime soon. So, you know, just, so it is. So that's one way to kind of not get panicked and so forth and so on, right? Which I find works, for me at least. You can try it. If I find other things, I'll let you know. I don't know offhand of, at least in this context, you know, what else to do. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Oh, yes. Oh, you were just going to hold it. Okay. All right. So then, why don't we go into the... So that was the meditation that I'm glad that I did in the beginning, because it definitely wouldn't have happened at the end. So then, we are going over the 8 verses of thought training, right? Mind training. Wait a minute. You know, that's a problem with modern technology. You can't really make them work. Okay, here we go. I'm just trying to bring up the... Okay. So I'll just review the first 2 verses that we did, right? Says, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I shall hold them dear at all times, right? When in the company of others, I shall consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. So that was the one where we talked about pride, right? And how humility is the antidote to pride, right? So now we're at verse 3, which says, vigilant the moment... So you have this in your readings, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, okay. So vigilant the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, I shall confront and avert it without delay. So this is talking about how to counter the delusions as they appear, right? So before we actually start, you know, reacting based on them, right? So it talks about delusions, right? So what are delusions? So delusions are the afflicted mind, right? The mind that is, you know, the any disturbing thought, right? And disturbing thoughts are, you know, all because of, you know, attachment, right? Or aversion. Anger. And ignorance, right? We know that, right? The 3 poisons, right? So any mind that is afflicted by those 3 things is a delusion, right? Because you know, there are causes for greater suffering. That's basically it, right? Whatever action we take based on those delusions are going to be causes of greater suffering, So the other reason it's delusions, why it's called delusion, is because it makes things appear to us in the way they're not at all, right? So, you know, we think things are true even though they're not, basically. Right? So that's why they're a delusion. So whatever, you know, situation you might be in, you know, whatever you're facing, if you're, you know, your pride, if your pride arises, right, or jealousy arises, and so forth and so on. If you look at it, right, if you look at it with a clear mind, you will see that it's based on something that is not true. So in this case, let's say pride arises, and you look at why is pride arising, who is proud, and so forth and so on, you'll find that the thing that is proud isn't like that at all, right? Or when we talked about it last time, right? You know, if you feel that you feel proud because you're wealthy, let's say, right? There is no as it said, you know, there is no reason to feel proud, pride. Because even though you may think that, you know, you're a self-made man and or woman and, you know, it's all because of you, right? That's not the case at all, right? First of all, even in this life, it's because of many other things. I mean, our efforts certainly had a great deal to do with it, right? But, you know, there were lots of other people who contributed, right? If we didn't have the food to eat, blah, 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 you know, we wouldn't be able to generate that wealth, right? So that's one way of thinking about it. A more Buddhist way to think about it would be that, you know, the reason we have this wealth is because we've created the causes for this wealth, right? And the causes were created in some other lifetime, right? So there's no reason to be proud about all my wealth in this life because it's, you know, the causes were there already, right? It's not, you know, so that's another way to think about it, right? So you can say there's many ways of examining these things that, you know, these afflicted minds that arise. And however we examine it, you'll find that it doesn't actually happen to be true. So that's why they're called delusions, right? And you know, the thing that's so powerful about the delusions is, you know, they appear to us as if they're going to bring us something that's, you know, let's take attachment, for example, right? It appears like if we follow our attachment, it's going to bring us some things that desirable, right? Whatever we desire at that moment, right? And, you know, it really, one doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with attachment. I mean, you know, if you think about it, the way our minds work, it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with following what we desire. The problem is that in the short term, it might give us what we want, right? But the long term, it really works against us. And that's where the problem arises. We create causes for greater suffering, even though in the short term we might win, right? It's like with anger as well. With anger, we can make someone do what we want. You know, if you're really forcefully angry, we can make someone do what we want in the short term, right? But even in this life, we know that in the long term, that person is not going to be really, you know, he may do what I want him to do, but he's thinking in the back of his mind how he's going to get back at me like a year from now, right? So it's like that, right? So they're all like that. You know, we think in the short term it's going to bring us benefit, but it really doesn't. And that's why they're so dangerous. You know, and we're constantly just following these things, right? So it talks about how, you know, it says, appears in my mind. So it says, vigilant, the moment delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others. So you see that part, right? And how it endangers us. Even though we get what we want, it's not saying that, you know, bring us happiness, right? It's saying endangering myself. The endangering part is coming, you know, the long-term danger. That's what it's talking about here, right? And it says, I shall confront and avert it without delay, right? So this is a part where, you know, it talks about having this constant vigilance. Right? Always thinking in our minds, whenever, you know, where thoughts appear, you know, or we're about to do something, you know, about body or speech, you know, we should be examining in our minds, okay, what is the basis of this thought, right? What is, you know, if I want to do something, let's say, why am I doing this, right? Constant examining, you know, what is the state of my mind? Is it a deluded mind right now, right? You know, I want the new big iPad really badly, right? And I find myself at times like really thinking about it, you know? And even though I really don't need it, this one works really well. I mean, you know, I bought it used like 2 years ago and it's beautiful. I mean, you know, maybe 3 years ago, I don't know. But you know, it has perfect, right? But I still want that big one because it would look so much bigger, you know, everything I read. Anyway. So where was I going with this? Oh, so yeah, so I mean when I think about it, right, if I think about it, why I'm really, you know, it's not because of some utilitarian, you know, it would be one thing if it was utilitarian value, right? It will, you know, I need it to do something, so X, Y, and Z, right? But it's not because of that at all, right? It's because I want one, right? I want to, you know, have a bigger, better one, shinier one, right? Which is a, you know, perfect example of attachment, right? And, you know, it's a pretty silly one, you know, but that's the one that came on top of my head. But you can think of many things in your life, right, that you're really attached to. And I don't mean attachment as in, you know, love for your spouse or whatever. I mean, I just mean that there are lots of things that are clearly, you know, just attachments. And we really grasp at them, you know, we follow them. We try to get them whenever we can and so forth and so on, right? So that's the, we all should always be thinking, that's where it talks about vigilance. I don't know if, you know, I wasn't able to come to Geshe-la's this weekend's class, but I'm sure if he talked about calm abiding, I'm sure he talked about mindfulness and vigilance. Did he talk about mindfulness and vigilance and calm abiding? Yep, he must have, right? Because those are two things you must have to develop calm abiding, right? So mindfulness is, you know, is, I don't know the definition he used, but the one I know from the Lam Rim is, you know, remembering the instruction and applying antidotes, right? But vigilance is the one where you have this mind constantly in the back, right? You know, you're doing your calm abiding meditation. And every, you know, to get through the zero through, first to the ninth levels, right? Placement and so forth and so on, right? You have to think, what is my mind doing right now? Right? Where am I? Should I be tightening or loosening? Right? He must have talked about that, right? And so that vigilance is what he's talking about here, right? That's exact same vigilance, right? So we have to have that vigilance, this extra little mind out of the, I always point up here, I don't know where it is really, but it's extra mind that's up here, right? That is looking down and just constantly surveying, what is my rest of my mind doing, right? So, you know, so that's the vigilance we should have. You know, you think it's, I'll tell you one thing, like, if you do the calm abiding meditations, you know, if you actually notice your thoughts, you will find all kinds of interesting things. Like, for example, you know, I go on retreat like once a year and do the calm abiding, right? 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks calm abiding meditation. And if you sit long enough and you notice your thoughts, you will see patterns. Like I know, for example, whatever my thought arises. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because, you know, this thing up here, right? But I know, for example, when a thought appears for me, it always appears from the bottom right and goes to the top left and then dissipates. So there is a, it's not, I'm not making this up, right? So there is actually a, you know, when it arises, it always appears to me from the bottom right. And it always goes away, the top left. So, you know, don't laugh at these things back here, you know. Anyway, sorry.
It's
all right. Somebody had yes.
I certainly don't have command of the teachings, but one of the things that I've noticed that the vigilance is doing for me, because I really don't want the negative to come in, I catch it and I just say stop. And just the energy that it takes to say stop disrupts it. And I'm sitting there going, where the heck did that come from? But it diffuses that process, and then I can work with it from there. But just the word stop has really helped me realize what my mind is doing to my heart, really.
So that's really good. Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, there are many ways of stopping those kinds of thoughts, right? Or, yeah, those kind of mental states. One is the forceful way, like you said, right? Stop. Right? I mean, and in the teachings they talk about where it's like, actually, I don't know. It's with a teacher. I don't know if it's, he said that it's kind of like, you know, when you have an apple or tomato on the chopping board and you like use a knife and you go, you know, like that, right? It's just like that. That's the forceful approach, right? Which is what you're talking about. There's another approach, which is, like where you kind of just observe, right? And it dissipates by itself, right? You just sit there and you just notice it and you see that you realize it's just a thought. No more, no less. Thoughts have no inherent quality to them, right? There's no inherent attribute to thoughts. They don't have any solidity, right? And so, but we think that thoughts are real. I mean, that's how our mind works, right? The moment that a thought appears, I am that person, right? If a thought appears, if a happy thought appears, I'm happy right now. I am happy. The me is happy, right? And if something, you know, if we had a certain expectation of how our day was going to go and it didn't quite go that way, I mean, you know, I'm really down. I am down, right? Now, it's not that I don't say I'm having a down thought. We don't say that, right? I'm down. That's what we say. Right? So that's what I'm talking about. So when you do these things, you realize that they're just thoughts. It's nothing more, nothing less, right? They're ephemeral things, but we give them so much value. This is another way the self exists, right? This is how the self also appears, right? You know, it's totally solid for us, right? But it's totally ephemeral. There's nothing there. You know, if you really look at, anyway, I'm going into emptiness now, but that's what the emptiness is about, right? So there's many ways of applying these things to these types of negative mental states, right? And so you can use a forceful approach. You can use the approach of just watching it, you know, which works for me. The forceful one doesn't quite work for me as well, right? But I know people for whom that really works, like you, you know? So there are other things people do. For example, what works for me sometimes is, you know, as I'm sure as like you, I have a relatively judgmental mind as well, right? So, so whenever I'm, you know, like if I see someone walking down the street and I'm some, you know, it's weird, right? I mean, just a person walking down the street, but your mind immediately like starts labeling, right? And so, you know, so like if a mind like that appears to me, I will, you know, I had the slogan, I came up with a slogan like observe, not judge, right? So I will have the slogan come up in my mind, right? Observe, not judge, right? So it's kind of a reminder to myself, right? That, okay, there it is again, right? I don't need to go there, right? So like that, right? So there are many ways of doing this, but the bottom line is we have to be vigilant, right? Because they're the door to, you know, as it says, the door to all our suffering, right? And so, you know, I'll bring it up. I mean, this is where a little bit of kind of knowledge about how, you know, at least from Buddhist point of view, how minds work, it helps. So I'll kind of give you a quick run summary of, so in, so, you know, so basically, whenever we perceive something, you know, of smell, taste, touch, sight, you know, et cetera, right? We have a mind arises, right? So when I see something, right, I see this cushion, right? The eye awareness, right? The eye, ear, nose, all these things have a special awareness with them, right? So when I see something and eye awareness arises, right? And the awareness doesn't do anything other than just hold the object, right? It doesn't judge. It doesn't do anything. It just, you know, it sees the, you know, the cushion, or, and that's it, right? It's just a mind is basically something that's aware. That's it. Okay. But along with that arises what's called the five omnipresent mental factors. Five things that arise simultaneously with that mind, right? So it's feeling, discrimination, intention, attention, and contact. But the most important thing to remember is feeling and discrimination, right? The first thing that appears, not the first thing, along with the mind, my seeing the cushion, what appears is, number one, feeling. Feeling here doesn't mean emotions. Feeling here means, do I like it? Is it a like it? Or do I not like it? Or am I neutral to it? That's what feeling here means. This is the definition of feeling. So the first thing that arises to me, simultaneously arises, do I like it or not? Right? I'm neutral to this cushion. So that's my feeling, right? Then comes discrimination, where I basically I'm seeing something, a cushion, a red cushion versus a red pillow or something, right? That's the discrimination, right? And then there's attention and intention, right? So the cushion is not a good example. Let's say that, you know, I see an attractive woman, let's say, okay? Let's go all out. So I see an attractive woman, right? So there's my feeling, you know, I feeling arises, right? She's attractive, right? And then the discrimination also arises, right? It's a woman, et cetera, et cetera, not a man, et cetera, right? And then, feeling discrimination. And then my intention, you see, the intention arises. The intention is the thing that propels me towards that woman, right? That's the karma, that's all the stuff that I've created in the past, the baggage, right? And the intention, they call it intention, it's like, how does intention work here, like with awareness? Like intention, what it talks about is, it's like a magnet, how it pulls the iron, whatever you call it, filaments? No, whatever, those filings, right? Whatever they're called. Anyway, those iron things. So it's kind of like the magnet that pulls you, right? That's the intention. The intention pulls me towards that attractive woman, to my mind, right? Certainly. Pulls my mind towards that attractive woman, right? And then the attention is where I'm like really like looking at, you know, like paying attention to her, right? Her qualities, right? So all these things appear. I'm not going into contact and all that stuff, but that's okay. But that's how whenever anything or any perception that we have of feel, of eye, of sight, smell, taste, whatever, the other two sense, things. And then, of course, there's the mental consciousness. There's five sense consciousnesses of these, you know, eye, et cetera. And then there's the last one, which is mental consciousness, you know, the thoughts and so forth and so on, right? So everything that arises like that in our awareness has all this built into it, right? And that's where the vigilance comes in, right? When the intention appears, right, we have to think. Before we start, you know, because after that, the judging and all that stuff comes, right? After the five things appear, then comes the positive or negative, what's called mental factor, right? Of pride or jealousy or compassion is positive. Pride and jealousy are negative. And so vigilance is positive, right? All these things appear, right? So that's the, you know, so it's a little bit of background kind of helps kind of understand how our mind works, right? And you can go into, you know, there's lots of books written about this. You can go into detail, you know. So that's where the vigilance comes in, is that's the mind back there that is just surveying, right? And and that's why meditation works, right? Meditation work, you know, like morning meditation or all these meditations, that why they work is because it builds up that vigilant mind, right? We kind of can see, you know, we kind of build up that mind where it starts surveying, and it pops up at times during the day. You know, if we are really accomplished, then we'll be there at all time. But of course, we're not there yet, right? So it pops up once in a while, right? But it does pop up. That's the interest. You know, before we started meditation, it never popped up, right? We just followed our mind wherever it went, right? But we kind of start getting more control, right? We see the thoughts for what they are, right? Just thoughts. Or if they're really overpowering and there's like that intention, the magnet, right? It's pulling me towards something attractive. Then the thing pops up and it starts asking, okay, why am I doing this? Right? Why am I thinking about this attractive woman? Is it positive? Is it negative? Right? Am I married? That would be a good question, right? So, you know, which I am. So, you know, but in any case, so those kinds of things come up, right? So that's where the vigilance is, why vigilance is important. It stops us from, you know, way before we would even think about approaching that woman, right? It was way, you know, but if it weren't there, maybe I would, right? But I mean, I have this vigilance, right? I'm thinking, okay, that's probably not a positive thing because it's based on attachment, right? In Buddhism, the attachment is attachment to others' body, right? That's what it's based on, right? So it's, you know, attachment to self, attachment to other things, including others' body, it's called, right? So anyway, if it's negative, right? So I shouldn't be following it. So that's why it's always good to be thinking about it. So anyway, so that's that verse, right? That's how, you know, it's all how it, all this builds into transforming our problems. The class is called Transforming Problems, right? Transforming Problems isn't just about transforming our immediate problems today, right? Like we do take this class for 6 sessions and we will be able to solve our problems. Unfortunately, that doesn't work that way, right? But it does transform future problems. It ameliorates present problems. If we're able to use these techniques, you know, of compassion and so forth and so on, like my friend, you know, with pain in the middle of the night, etc., it can ameliorate present problems, but it can certainly remove future problems. Okay. And then the next verse, so that's the one about vigilance, right? The next verse talks about, let me read it first. Whenever I see beings who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering, I shall hold such rare ones dear as if I had found a precious treasure. That's a tough one. And, you know, we're not really geared towards seeing those who are wicked in nature as dear, right? It's a real change in our thought processes. What does it mean by wicked in nature? I mean, it basically means, you know, someone who is overwhelmed by the poisons, right? Attachment, anger, ignorance. Someone who's acting based on those three things, right? And all the other delusions arise from those three, right? Pride, jealousy, you know, wrong, you know, all those things, right? They arise from that. So that's what it means by wicked in nature and overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering. So the interesting thing is that it talks about violent negative actions and suffering, right? Overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering. So, you know, that's the interesting bit, right? The person who is in front of us, who is treating us, let's say, unfairly or acting out of anger, maybe even violence, so forth and so on, right? They're going through some intense suffering. I mean, we're suffering, of course, right, as the recipient, right? But they are going through intense suffering, right, because of which they're acting out in that way, right? And in most cases, they don't even know why they're acting out in that way, in most cases, right? And that's the thing that we can't see. I mean, we can't seem to understand, right? I mean, when we're faced with that situation, it's really hard to see the suffering in the other person. But that's what allows us to see them as precious, right? It's when we see that they're not that different from us, right? I mean, they're suffering just as we are.
Is it because you have such great compassion for them that you see them as being so dear?
Sure, yes, absolutely, right? But we also see it because we see our own suffering, right? We know how much we suffer. I mean, the thing is that no one in this room can say that they have never been angry and acted out of anger, right? We are just as prone to do it as the person in front of us, right? So we have suffering, we have suffering just as much as, the other person has suffering just as much as I do, right? So that equalizes it to some extent, and I know how precious I hold myself, right? So that person deserves the same, they're no less worthy than we are in a way, right? So that's one way to look, yes.
But another thing that happens is that in that person and their behavior, I see the fact that I could be that vicious or that wicked or that unkind or cruel, that I have just as much capacity as that person to be and do that. And it's kind of, to me, a reminder that I don't want to go there, but this person doesn't know that they don't have to go there.
Right. That's right. I mean, the thing is that, I mean, I think His Holiness said this once, is that, the person in front of us is a reflection of us. That person is not really, not no less, more or less human than we are. Has more or less qualities than we have, right? And they make the same mistakes as we do, right? So that's why when it talks about compassion, right? It says, when the teachings talk about compassion, it says that first you have to develop compassion. I mean, you have to first, one who does not understand the nature of one's own suffering cannot generate compassion. Okay? Because you have to understand the nature, each of us has to understand the nature of our suffering, how it exists, how we suffer, not just on a daily basis, but from life to life and so forth and so on, right? So only then can we actually generate compassion for others. Right, so we have to have the introspection. We are no less wicked in nature. But here, it doesn't mean like wicked as in like we're just bad, right? It really means that we are under the power of delusions, right? Power of attachment, anger, and ignorance, right? Our nature is suffering basically because we are governed by ignorance.
It says violent negative actions.
So
doesn't mean that. I mean, I think doesn't part of it come with the wisdom as well? Because if I'm standing there and I'm in front of someone with directed towards me, it does not necessarily mean that you have to stay in that situation.
Right. That's right. I was going to get there. But I'm glad you brought it up. Yes. It doesn't mean that, we just, we have to use our compassion, you know, we have to feel compassion for the other person, but it does not mean that we endanger ourselves, right? Because if we endanger ourselves, and then one way to think of it, if we endanger ourselves, we're not really any good to anybody else, right? If we're trying to help other beings, and if we basically get ourselves killed, it's not really all that effective, right? I mean, seriously, right? But also it's because we have to use wisdom, right? At that moment, it's not, may not necessarily be the right thing to do anyway, right? For that, to give the opportunity to the other person to commit some kind of violent action, right? Think about it like that, right? So, you know, if you remove yourself from the situation, that person probably can't do something terribly negative, right? So that's another way to think about it, right? So we should still feel compassion for that person, right? We can remove ourselves from the situation. And Geshe-la talks about this, right? He says that, look, if you're a bodhisattva or a Buddha, you'd probably stand there and you would know what to do, the right thing to do. Or maybe even in that case, a Buddha or bodhisattva would leave because maybe that's not the right thing at that moment for that person, right? But nevertheless, you'd know what to do, right? But he said, in our ordinary minds, with our ordinary minds, we don't really know at this point, at this moment, what is the right thing to do. And so if you can't, you don't know what the right thing to do and be in that situation, the best thing to do is leave the situation, right? Remove yourself from the situation, right? So if we're in a, you know, like a, you know, a lot of times, you know, like if one is in a dysfunctional relationship and so forth and so on, right? It's not clear what is the right thing to do. It's very, very difficult. I mean, you know, almost impossible with our current minds, right? To know what is the right thing to do. But sometimes the right thing to do maybe is not to be there at all. Right? Maybe the hard thing to do, but maybe it's the right thing to do. You know? Like that.
So I really like this topic. I dig this topic because it helps me be more open-minded. So one thing, and I practiced this, okay, in my mind, how I would deal with Donald Trump if he was in front of me and spouting off his nonsense, right? And if I know if I get angry and go, you know, throw a few expletives at him, you know, some of his supporters are going to probably crank me over the head. But if I, you know, if I was just a little bit softer and just realize the guy's passionate about something and just came from a little bit more softer, compassionate side and said, okay, yeah, you're a little, you know, just, it would probably lead to a conversation and maybe it changes something, right? You know, but if that, seriously, I pictured him saying stuff to me and me not reacting. And that got my compassion up for him. You know?
You know, I mean, you know, I don't know about Donald Trump, but I was just going to say that, you know, he just has a larger megaphone. So what he says, you know, goes farther and, you know, et cetera, right? But, you know, we say stupid things too, right? You know, I mean, we just happen to not, you know, be on TV, right? So, you know, so I try not to get too wrapped up about Donald Trump, you know, or over the current politics, you know, I mean, it does, you know, I have my likes and dislikes about politics, but the way I look at it, you know, it's all cause and conditions, right? It's not going to be the end all be all, right? I mean, there's so many cycles in our lives, in our previous lives, in this country's life, right? Sooner or later, the pendulum will swing the other way again, right? So it's not like, you know, just because it is how it is now means that it's going to be like this forever, right? Anyway, but that's another story. So I mean, we can relate to people in a better way like that, right? I mean, that's all it's talking about is that trying to get ourselves out of thinking that we're superior or, you know, this person is bad, right? Well, I don't mean Donald Trump here. I just mean that this person who is, you know, shouting at me or treating me unfairly, that person is bad, right? And so we kind of have to, you know, we can kind of engage with them differently, right? But using our wisdom again, right? Like, you know, not being there if it actually endangers us, right? And, you know, and then when the attitude arises that this person is just bad, evil, right? Somebody actually, last week, somebody told me, this person is just evil. I don't know. I hadn't heard somebody say that years, right? I just can't remember what context that was now. But anyway, I don't know. Last time evil was brought up with a person, I thought it was Hitler. You know, I don't know. You know? Anyway, so somebody said that person is evil, and I was thinking, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you label somebody like that because that person is, you know, at that moment, right, is terrible, you know? It's hurting us, right? So we label them as evil, and that just stops the conversation right there, right? There's nothing to follow that, right? Once you say somebody's evil, I think it ends right there, right? But, you know, but that's where the idea of emptiness and all that stuff comes in, right? I mean, because you see that what is, you know, you examine and you see that this person that you're labeling as evil, how is this person evil? Who is evil? I mean, there's all these things that one can apply, right? To kind of, you know, that's where the vigilance against comes in, right? You know, so I'll give an example, right? So those of you who have partners or spouses, I'm sure this is not uncommon occurrence for you. So, but you know, like every so often my wife will tell me, point out one of my foibles, right? And, you know, and I, you know, immediately this whole thing about how unfairly I'm being treated pops up, right? You know, it's just, you know, how could she, you know, all those other times I wash the dishes, right? Or whatever it is, right? She has to point out this one time, right? And so, and then, this whole thing arises, right? But it's interesting, if you've done this practice of vigilance, right? You immediately kind of think, oh, there it is again, right? You see the self arises. I know exactly how it feels, right? Like in my body, right? I know exactly because I've done this exercise, right? A lot, right? And, you know, you can see that, you can see the self and you see, oh, there it is again, right? I kind of just take a pause. You know, I remember standing next to the closet like about a couple of weeks ago and my wife was shouting down the stairwell. And so I was like in the closet, I'm thinking, oh, there it is again, right? And I'm thinking, oh, you know, and where is this thing? You know, I'm just really, I can feel it right there where, you know, it's interesting. You do this exercise and, you know, you don't really feel all that, you know, it just goes away, you know? I mean, the whole thing about pride and my self, you know, the thing that arises, you know, it just kind of dissipates. It's like the thought, right, that rises, comes up here and goes over there, you know, like for me, you know? Just like that. It just kind of disappears, you know? And so when you do that, you know, you don't hold grudges, you know? You kind of forget, you know, I don't even remember what it was about, to be honest, you know? And so, you know, it just makes life so much easier, to be honest, you know, if one is able to kind of use these techniques. Anyway, I think I've used up all my time. I'll stop there for this. Did you have, anybody have any last minute questions? So I hope that, okay, so for homework, please, I encourage you to do that taking and giving practice, right? It's very easy. You know, white smoke in, destroy the self-cherishing thought, black smoke out, think about all the beings and their suffering, alleviates, you know. So I encourage you to do that, right? And, you know, see if you can use this idea of vigilance, right? See if you can, during the week, remind yourself, like, you know, set a motivation in the morning, right? You know, I will try to, you know, set a motivation. You get up in the morning, you set a motivation saying, okay, I'm going to try to apply this vigilance. You know, whenever a thought arises, I'm going to try to see what arises, right? Just, you don't even have to counteract it. You don't have to use antidotes or do any of that stuff, right? Just Just be aware of what is arising. That's all, right? See if we can do that. I mean, it would be it's a fun exercise. It's a really fun exercise, you know? And, I mean, you don't even have to do the hard work of applying the antidote. That's actually a lot harder than just being aware of it, right? So just, you know, just so that's, and then the other thing I was going to say is that if you could, you know, in the gold book, whatever, I have the old version, but in the Lam Rim, the liberation in the hand, in the liberation in the palm of your hand book, you know, there's the readings. So if you could read we're the third one. So if you could read the first third of that reading, you know, there's like 50 pages, so maybe if you can read 15 pages or something like that, right? The first few sections. Because that'll kind of talks about all these things, right? But from a much more concrete way, I guess. Is that it? Okay, so let's finish with our dedication. So page 235 in our prayer book. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Thank you very much. See you next week.